Welcome to the Behind the Bits podcast. Your host, Scott Curtis, wants to learn everything he can about stand-up comedy and take you along for the ride. Scott and his guests talk serious about comedy in every episode. Behind the Bits will uncover knowledge from different perspectives on subjects such as writing and performing stand-up comedy, as well as booking shows and the comedy life. If you're thinking about becoming a stand-up comic, already in the comic game, or a comedy nerd, Behind the Bits is the show for you. Now, let's get Behind the Bits.
Steven.
Hey, Scott, how are you?
Good. Thanks for being on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored, and thank you for saying I'm likable. Already, I'm thrilled.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I did a lot of deep digging into your all the videos that you put up, and that was one thing that seemed fairly universal. And there's one thing I wanted to ask you. I did some really deep digging, and I found one clip. It's a very short clip where you said you like metal music. And now, do you really like metal music, or was that just for the joke?
No. My first concert was Alice Cooper.
Oh, nice.
And I've seen him, I think, 15 times.
Oh, wow.
Huge fan.
Yeah.
I mean, older, what's considered older metal.
Yeah.
But like, you know, that kind of stuff is truly, I'm obsessed with Alice, but
yeah.
Like all that kind of level stuff is.
That's funny. Alice was actually my first because my cousin was a big Alice Cooper fan. And this is back in the 70s.
Yeah.
So it was back when, you know, he was hot. And and I remember I stayed the night at her house, and we were watching like Creature Feature, but she had all these Alice Cooper posters up, and I'm like, well, who's this guy? So she started playing the albums, and that was my my first metal love. And then I went on to Judas Priest has kind of stayed with me ever since. They're kind of my band. I've got a Judas Priest belt buckle, and I'm pretty proud of that. Yeah,
that's awesome. That's so cool. Yeah, I would listen to that stuff all through high school and middle school as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten into vinyl, so I it's just growing and growing and growing. I love it so much.
Yeah, the whole vinyl thing, the resurgence is just nuts. I'm really glad it's happening. I can't really take advantage of the warmer sound that vinyl has because I'm deaf. So I'm not 100% deaf, but deaf enough that I'm not going to notice any more warmth in a LP. But I do miss the days, because when we moved I ended up getting rid of my whole LP collection, and I do miss the days of taking them out and taking the album out, putting the needle on, looking at the cover and all that kind of stuff.
And Alice has his Alice Cooper Goes to Hell album. The cover, and I'm new to all this, obviously. The cover to the album, like the sleeve, I guess you'd call it, inside, has like a backstory to, because he's a very concept album.
Yeah.
It has like backstory. And like, my name's Steven. I was named after Steven in the Welcome to My Nightmare album.
Oh, cool.
So, and to like a little for the nerd part of me, like, Steven's a little boy that's trapped in his own nightmare, and it's a character that keeps coming up in Alice's music. And some of the album sleeves, they're referencing the character. And for me, it gives me extra goosebumps because it's my name.
Yeah, so yeah. Cool. Yeah, that's really neat.
I love it.
Yeah, that's a cool story. Now, one of the things, this is very evident in your act, is your anxiety. Mm-hmm. So I got to ask, why would somebody who has anxiety get into stand-up comedy? Because it's the most anxious thing you can do.
I'm a very obsessive person, as I've already shown. I think it was Wendy Liebman was the first comedian I saw as far as on TV. I think it was like a half hour on HBO. And I remember, I don't know how old I was, but she's like super rapid fire. I think she's from Boston. So it's like, it was just, it blew my mind. And I think I was young enough that I didn't catch everything, but the audience reaction and then what it did to my parents was insane to me, because my parents were and still part of my world, but they were my entire world back then.
Right.
And I'm like, oh my God, this woman in the TV is changing the room in here. Uh-huh. It's like crazy. And I immediately became obsessed. And then I think Carson retired before I was born, but somehow I remember growing up watching maybe like reruns or clips or something. And then Letterman stand-up appearances, like anyone that did late night with Letterman, I remember watching those. And then Dangerfield, and then Jim Carrey movies were another huge part of, just like, I became this comedy nerd as a child. It was so fun. And my parents were like, oh, great, let's watch comedy with him. And then they would introduce me to new comedy, old comedy. It was really cool. And then started taking me to live shows when I was, I think, in high school or getting out. Mm-hmm. And just short-term answer, I was obsessed. And
yeah.
I wanted to do it so badly.
Well, that's really cool. So what was it like when you got up that first time?
I was so bad. Uh-huh. I was so bad. And I was so nervous. I also have this, and this is a typical for people with anxiety. No matter, even though I was desperate to do it and be good at it, I kept putting it off. And I was, I remember I was a swimmer in high school. I remember being on the deck of the pool talking to the other swimmers and someone going, you know, there's a comedy club in town. You can go there. I was like, oh, I guess I could. And I was so nervous. I remember I called and got and just chickened out and never showed up to an open mic or something. And then there was an open mic locally at like a waffle. It's called Funkin' Waffles. It was like a music venue that served waffles.
Okay.
somehow I just ended up going there, checking it out. Trying it, I wouldn't even call that me trying it for the first time. It was just bad. And then a club opened in my hometown, Syracuse Funny Bone. And you could submit for guest spots opening weekend. And my friend sent me a link. He's like, just do it. And I had done it for my graduation party for my family. My dad was like, if you're not going to do it for your family, you're not going to do it for strangers.
Uh-huh.
I had a couple of like attempts at it. So I went and did this opening night at the club, and I don't remember anything that I said, but it went well enough. And a local comic came up to me after and was like, hey, you're good enough. Let's show you how you're supposed to do this. And he took me under his wing.
Okay.
And that kind of just started it all off.
Okay. What was when you first started, what was your first material about?
I remember it being about my parent, like living at home, parents, some dating stuff. I was writing at that time. I was writing what I thought you were supposed to write about.
Yeah.
And I was being the comedian I thought people wanted instead of like, what do I think's funny? So thankfully I've blocked most of that out.
Yeah.
Because it was bad. But yeah, I think it was your typical, I was 20, so your typical whatever a 20-year-old would talk about.
Yeah, so you've definitely evolved. How many years have you been doing stand-up?
9 years.
9 years? That's a good time to be doing stand-up. You know, that 9-10 years is when you really, really hit your stride. And
yeah, I remember when I think it was my first year, I met a 9-year-in comedian. He was like the feature at the club.
Uh-huh.
And just, it blew my mind that someone, I was like, oh my God, he's been doing it forever. And then now I'm 9 years in. I'm like, I don't know anything.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one good thing in comedy, to know that you never know anything, because everything changes.
Oh yeah.
So your material is so, it's so personal, and you really attack subjects that could be, you know, it could be taken a lot more seriously, or you could be darker with it, and yet you keep it really light and still shine a light on, you know, what anxiety's like, and what, you know, how interacting with people is like with anxiety, and how every day starts and ends. And it's just really, you really have a great flow on how you do that. And I mean, you were really able to pull out 6 minutes and 20 seconds on Colbert just about anxiety. So thinking about getting on Colbert, what was that like? How did it happen? And what was it like being backstage, getting ready to go on?
Oh man. So, like I mentioned, late night was the catalyst for me. Mm-hmm. So and that's all I've ever wanted to do. So at a certain point when I started to learn how to write jokes, it was all with the envision of telling it on a late night.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, I owe a lot to the Lucy Fest in Jamestown, New York. It's now home of the National Comedy Center.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a festival, Lucy Fest, that I was able to be on. And the booker of the late show was there. And as soon as I got off stage, I knew she was in the audience, but I had 15 minutes. And I was like, I'm just going to have fun.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully something, you know. But more important, have a good show. Don't worry about that one person. And I get off stage, and I had already gotten a message on social media like, hey, have you been on TV? Would you like to meet up for coffee? And thankfully, me and the booker both had the same ideas. I was like, I want to do the whole anxiety chunk.
Uh-huh.
And she was like, that's what I want. And I was like, oh that's this great. Is great.
Yeah.
I was so excited, and I'm dating a comedian, Caitlin Palufo, and at the time we've been friends longer than we were dating. At the time, I was being her sounding board because she was about to be on Colbert. She would send me her jokes and go, "I did this change. What do you think?" So I was familiar with the process, and Caitlin was about to be on, and we had just started dating by the time Caitlin recorded. I was supposed to be on that same date as well, but they bumped me because they had too many comics.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went to support Caitlin and my friend Samantha Ruddy, because they used to do it in a showcase. I think they're back to doing single comics now. But so I went and saw the whole process, and that eliminated a lot of anxiety for me. Also, I saw what her green room experience was like. She had her dad back there. She had her new boyfriend back there. She had her best friends, and it was like a fun hang. And then she just jumped on stage and murdered.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay, it's not all that different than being in a green room at a club and being like, I'm going to go do my spot. Let's continue this when I get back.
Yeah.
So when it was my turn, I had my father back there, and a bunch of comics. Caitlin was out of town, which probably helped. I don't want to.
Yeah.
Kill my girlfriend. So it kept me loose. I think sometimes you think, oh, this is a huge show I'm doing. You know, it's a comedy contest. It's a blah, 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 whatever. Mm-hmm. And you think you got to treat it differently than Friday night bar show. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you killed on that Friday night bar show because you just focused on having a good time.
Right.
Instead of treating it like it's the biggest deal ever. Also, that's obviously easy for me to say in hindsight. But so I wanted it to be a normal hang. The only time that was like truly like, holy hell, was when you could see the crowd, like they had the monitors in the green room.
Yeah.
And they turned it to the audience because at one point they had it on the empty seats. Mm-hmm. They moved the camera around and then it was full. And I was like, well, this is terrifying. And what they do is they'll have you stand right at the edge of the backstage. So you're out in like 0.5 seconds. And what they do is they have their hand on your back. And then once they push, it's truly like skydiving.
Yeah.
Once they push, you have to go. And then all of a sudden I'm out there. And that was, yeah.
Yeah, I watched that clip through a few times and I really watched the beginning because that first 2 seconds, I could see the deer in headlights just for that amount of time, and then you overcame it real quick and got into it. But yeah, I could, because I've seen myself do that, because you know I've got some anxiety myself, and it's really especially when you have time to build it up, as far as the anxiety is concerned, once you get out there, if you let it overtake you, man, it can just really annihilate you. And good for you for being able to push right through it.
I have a added bonus that I've done theaters. I think that helped me a lot because some people, that was their first theater experience,
right?
And you know, because it's your first late night.
Yeah,
but I knew to acknowledge the balcony. I'm also obsessed with late nights currently, so I'm always watching them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's fun, but so many people are like, well, the camera's down here, so I'm just gonna pan left to right or look at the camera. But it's mm-hmm. like there's an entire balcony of audience members you're ignoring.
Yeah.
So I made sure, and I think I saw my late night, like whatever, not that long after, and I remember being like, oh, I'm looking at everybody. And that was something I'm glad the anxiety didn't take away from me.
Right.
Because I want everyone to know I'm there for them.
Yeah. And that's really evident in all the clips I've seen, especially the ones where you're aware enough of the audience. I mean, you got the sleeping guy, but you also have different things come up where people don't know the definition of a word you said or something like that. Yeah. And you're really able to jump into that and bring the audience along with you. And I wouldn't even really call it crowd work. It's just really acknowledging what the audience is giving back to you and giving it back to them. And it really, it seems to really make your set more solid by being able to jump in and out like that.
Thank you, because that's something I've worked on. I don't dislike crowd work at all.
Uh-huh.
But it is not what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because the big thing that works about crowd work is it was an in the moment thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, everybody's like, oh my God, this is a crazy moment. And it's like, there's other moments that will happen naturally.
Yeah.
Without you having to go, what's with those shoes?
Yeah.
Like, because maybe it is like, what do you do for a living may register with me and maybe something I'm interested in, want to hear about. Mm-hmm. And then I'll do that. But I don't like just starting it because it's unpredictable. Oh, now we can talk. Oh, you know, it opens a door to so much possible chaos.
Right. Yeah.
But if it's, just in the moments that I'm making with the material, it's safer because it's still on my end. And I'm taking some of the credit away from myself. Obviously, it is interesting that I can do this off the top of my head, but it is safer than crowd work.
Yeah.
All this is because I don't think anybody wants to see a comedian that's not really there.
Right.
The best, like Gary Shandling, I work with Regan a lot. Brian Regan is an expert at being in the moment. Any comic that is truly present, still doing jokes, because that's all I want to do is tell my jokes.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't do the prompt, the autopilot prompter thing.
Right.
If somebody laughs harder at the setup than the punchline, I'm going to point that out and be like, oh, that's interesting, that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. So I love doing that.
Now, you've been working with Brian Regan for a while, and I find that to be an interesting pairing because you guys, even though you're both pretty clean and, you know, all American guys and all that kind of stuff, but your act is quite a bit different than his, and your energy is quite a bit different too. So it seems like it's a weird pairing until you know, well, you don't want the two people performing together be exactly alike. So right. Has that worked out that you guys really complement each other in that way?
Yeah, I think, I owe Brian everything. Mm-hmm. I could spend the rest of this time talking about how great he is.
Yeah.
I'm glad. The only thing I watch him every night. I'm really glad that not.
Oops.
That me.
That was me.
Are we getting on? Is he on?
Is it just. I have no idea how that happened. I think my phone is Bluetooth to my soundboard.
Wow.
And Bluetooth is off. Okay.
Like, actually, Brian's here.
So, yeah. Sorry about that.
No, I'm glad I complimented him. What was it? Oh, I watch him every night. I'm glad that I'm not doing Brian.
Yeah.
You know, there's 100% influence on me. I see it myself, mm-hmm. but I'm not trying to do what he does because that's not who I am. And I think that's why I still work with him. Mm-hmm. I think he notices that. I think he notices the complimenting more than I do. I'm too much of a fanboy to notice everything that he's doing.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm just like, holy crap, I'm still working with him. I do think that that is something that's happening. And I'm glad that I'm different enough because I think the audience would see right through it too and not give me anything or mm-hmm. even be worse and yell. So I'm glad it's different enough. But yeah. It's not on purpose. I'm just being myself.
Right. How did he discover you?
Same festival as the Colbert Book.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, 2 years earlier.
Uh-huh.
But same festival.
That's really neat. Now,
yeah.
I'm sure that having that gig with Brian has expanded your fan base in mm-hmm. by quite a bit. How does that work with you being able to expand your fan base like that?
It's been, I'm so grateful because I get to play around in a theater for 20 minutes. It's my favorite thing ever. Mm-hmm. I love it so much. He's shown me that that's something, you know, you do a certain gig and you're like, oh, I want to do this all the time.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I feel. I would love to do theaters one day. And I get to show a room full of theater comedy goers some, you know, my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't hold it against anyone that doesn't follow me because they're there to see him.
Right.
But Regan fans are diehard comedy fans and they want jokes.
Uh-huh.
So thankfully that's what I want to do. So I'll do is just say near the end of my set, if you want to block me, Stephen Rogers comedy,
uh-huh.
You know, they get the laugh, on that. And then that's all I'm going to say.
Right.
I'm more focused on being funnier than I am, like getting out on social media and bringing in followers.
Yeah.
So I'm glad most people won't be into me until they've seen me live. So it just kind of works out that he's giving me exposure to a lot of people.
Right. I've been working on this, this theory about comedy and how it's changed, because there's so many more of us now than there's a lot more comedians and there's a lot more comedy scenes in smaller cities. I'm in Huntsville, Alabama, and it's got a comedy scene, and it's really, and before that I was in South Bend, Indiana, and it had a comedy scene. It's, you know, smaller cities are definitely getting in on this, but there's so many that, you know, not everybody is going to get to the level that they want to. However, I try to compare this to music because I'm such a music fan, and I follow a lot of bands that aren't like top 40 hits. I mean, they're, and if I were to say their names, you wouldn't know them. A lot of people wouldn't know them, but they have this rabid fan base. And I go back to, I think it was Tim Ferriss that said, get 1,000 true fans and everything will build after that. And I'm seeing that as being, if you're a comedian and you concentrate on that versus trying to get to the masses right away, and you just keep building, like every time you do a set with a, you know, say 60, 100 people in the audience, and then 5% of them become a true fan, and you just keep building on that. I'm seeing that as being more a better way to go to be able to build that fan base and also get your career going to a point where when you go to a city, then all of a sudden they know who you are because there's enough fans in that city to say, hey, you should go see Stephen Rogers. Are you seeing that type of thing too?
That is my strategy, because it also is my strategy because that's what's happening. Nothing against the people that have massive followings on social media, but the issue with that, I think the problem that you can run into is you're showing them this killer 5 minutes. It's so strong, it's so funny, and then you blow up by, you know, getting it out there, however you do it, and or getting something early. You have a killer five and you're on at three channels already. You've already got the credits are filled on your poster. But the problem is that five is killer, but what happens after that five is done in the hour that you're now being booked for?
Yeah.
So I'm not saying what I'm doing is better. It's just like I'm so more focused on having as many good jokes as possible. And then, hopefully people find me. I'm also, I have imposter syndrome. So I can't be like posting shots of me on stage, like a selfie and like the crowd behind me going, killed it again.
Yeah.
I can't do it. And nothing against those people that can, because that's a tool and people will go see you.
Right.
But I don't have that in me. So I'm more like, I have an album coming out in May. I'm like holding on to those jokes. I'm not posting any of those clips until the album's out. And now it's like, here's a bunch. That's my strategy, is holding it until I'm sick of it and because it's all working and I'm not having any risk anymore.
Right.
That's just who I am. So it works out.
Yeah. And when you talk about having a lot of material, do you have like a standard writing process that you do, or are you more loose with it? How do you write, and how do you take it from something that you've written to the stage?
I'm focused on not being hard on myself anymore, too hard on myself anymore. I used to feel like, everything's got to be at, I had to have this rigid schedule, and it's just, for anxiety, creates more than it eases. So, what I'll do is when I'm ready to write, which is naturally proven to be in the morning, is I wake up, make coffee, play with the cat, and then I'm like, all right, time to get to work. I'll set a timer for an hour and just write whatever is on my mind. It's not free writing nonstop. It's just what's going on. Mm-hmm. What am I feeling kind of stuff. Remember hearing or reading somewhere, anytime you through the day you have an extreme change in emotions, that's probably something to play with. And I follow that a little bit. But I'll write for an hour, or I'll listen to an hour's worth of sets because I have a lot of 20-minute tapes from Brian stuff or spots in the city. So I'll listen to those. And then I have a Word doc that I call the hour, and it's just a transcribed of what's working on the tapes and what I want to say again. And that's a Goleman thing I remember learning.
Yeah.
That's roughly it. And I get very loose on stage when the moments present themselves and try to write on stage. But if it's, I don't push it too hard because I still want this set to go well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of what I do.
And once you get it on the stage, so say you've got a completely new bit and you get it on the stage, and how long do you give that bit before you say, I need to put that away for a while and maybe look at it later and rewrite it?
Caitlin and I were just talking about this. I have an issue with that. I have to get better at putting something down. That's what the hour doc does for me is I wrote so much during the pandemic to not go crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I have tons of stuff in that document that I think is a potential bit because I did it on Zoom shows or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of stuff. So it does naturally present, like I do naturally put stuff down and not touch it for a little while, only because I've overloaded the doc with stuff. And I color code things when they're where they are as far as quality. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of red. There's tons of red. So it's like there's a little too much to sift through. So that presents the putting something down.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm too stubborn to do it on purpose because I'm like, no, I got to figure this out now. It's gotta work right now. Mm-hmm. And so I accidentally found a way for it to naturally happen. But Caitlin's more of a, I got to put this down. And and I think she told me like a Mark Twain quote. It's like, he would do that. He would put something down. He'd like have manuscripts from years and years and then pick it up. So it's a very powerful tool. I think we should all be doing that, but I never find a way to do it on purpose.
Yeah. Do you ever take a bit and run it through in your head like you are performing it and actually you're the audience too, and you're trying to see it from both ways, the delivery and being in the audience?
I've never thought about the putting myself in the audience, except for that's not something I think about when I'm running it through. That's a great idea, which I can't believe I should be doing that. That's smart. So that's, I'm stealing that, but, but I'll say it out loud because you naturally say things shorter than, you know, you, it's almost like your brain's like, this word doesn't need, it's like a natural editor and I'll find shorter ways to say things, which I, is a big benefit of saying it out loud for me. And, back to that audience thing, I do that on stage, like, I'll put myself in the audience of what would I want to see in this bit right now, but that's more of physicality and energy and stuff. And I learned that from Brian. Brian always has always said to me, yeah, when I need to, I'll just picture myself out there in the audience and make myself laugh.
Yeah.
And, but I've never thought to do it off stage.
And it's something that I do, and it just comes naturally to me because I'm kind of a visualizer, and I like to run things through, and especially, at my age, and you've probably been through this too. You're always looking for references that can be as universal as possible. And when I think about my age, if I've got somebody, you're the same, you're younger than both my kids. And when I have somebody your age in the audience, if I mention the Waltons, the TV show, the Waltons, what percentage of your age group is going to get it? So I always have to, I have to bring it back and say, okay, what's going to work and what's not going to work. Now, if I'm in a room that's got 80% people my age or older, then I'm totally fine. But all the other stuff. And then I got to find out, you know, is the way I'm coming across, am I coming across as a grumpy old man, that's not where I want to be. I always want to be the guy, the weird uncle that is, thinks he's super hip. So he knows a few acronyms, but he doesn't know what they are. So I want to be right there, just weird enough to be, noticeable, but also not, be so weird that they're like, okay, this guy's, I'd be scared to be in a room with him. Right. So I'm trying to do that line. So I'm always running things through, and it's a different process. The different ages you are. And I'm sure you've probably experienced this. Have you ever done rooms where you've got like 80% of the audience is like my age?
Yeah, but I do better with your age than necessarily younger or like my age.
Yeah, you do. I mean, you are a classic style comedian, so I can see that. Yeah.
But I know the feeling but I'm learning, and I'm sure we all know, I remember a comic when I was starting looking in the room and going, oh, it's all old people tonight. My jokes don't work for old people. And I'm like, shouldn't the jokes be for everybody? And that's my philosophy. And then not necessarily, maybe it's better to just aim at one category. I don't know. Mm. But you mentioned before, the likable, lighthearted stuff. That's because that's sort of what I would do at a party with people is I want everyone to be included and I want everyone to be having a good time. I don't want anyone to be singled out or feel like they're out of place because that's how I feel. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of why I'm just like, no, this should work for everybody. It's just about being a human. It's not gender, race, or age specific. Uh-huh. But I still get intimidated by 20-something, cool people.
Yeah. Yeah, they're super cynical, jaded, and they watch so much YouTube that they've seen everything, so it's hard to win them over.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure it out still, but I know this. I do this cool room in the Lower East Side in New York. It's called Session Comedy, and it's all young, attractive, cool, 20-something people. Mm-hmm. And I've seen so many of us comics get intimidated by them. Even if every demographic of comic I've seen at one point go, you guys are too cool, this is weird. And then I'm realizing, oh, they don't want it. They don't want to hear that. Once we call them cool or... Once you call a crowd old, once you call a crowd anything, they're like, I think I forget it all the time. We all forget that everybody's processing everything, not just the material.
Yep.
So it's not like they're going to tune out once it's something you didn't want them to hear.
Right. Yep.
So I don't want to call a crowd anything anymore other than you guys are great. and I'll say, I say it a lot because I'm having fun. And, but the young people, I'm still trying to figure out. I also avoid references for the reasons you were mentioning. If I get two in my head.
Yeah.
the question, but.
Yeah. I enjoy the references because I like doing, I like getting the reference wrong, especially when I'm talking about young stuff. Like I always, I do, my wife and I have been together for 38 years and we're not just together. We're in love AF and then I say always and forever. And it just, that always hits. And
oh my God, that's killer.
Yeah. And even people my age know that. Yeah. So, yeah. So I try to do stuff like that, but I have to make sure that at least 80% of the audience knows the right definition of the reference so I can do the wrong.
I mean, it's so good. I'm obsessed with jokes. We're in love AF is hilarious. And then so much that I'm like, oh, that's, I love it when you think that's it. And
yeah.
Then you hit me so hard with the next one.
Yeah.
So,
well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll do that one tonight when I go out. We'll see.
Please. Do it for me. I'll feel it.
Yeah. So, being in a relationship with another comedian, what are the advantages and disadvantages of that?
Big advantages are we understand each other very well. Caitlin and I have canceled so many things on each other because we got something.
Uh-huh.
And we're aware that the night, once the sun goes down, it's a minefield, whether or not,
yeah,
you know, it's always changing.
Mm-hmm.
And we understand that about each other. So we have our dates during the day, you know, we just have, mm-hmm, our nights are switched, our days are switched or whatever.
Right.
And that's a nice load off that it's just understood.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a lot of one comic, non-comic relationships. And that's hard. I understand both sides. I've dated non-comics and felt bad every time I had to change things. So there's no guilt there, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
And the advantages are we'll be talking over dinner. We had a great dinner the other night. And then she was like, hey, can I tell you this joke I've been telling? And it's like, oh, yeah, this is like our version of tell me about your day.
Yeah.
And that's so fun. And she's so damn funny. Like, she's just a destroyer. So getting to watch her is always a treat. And people come up to me and say how much they love her. And I don't think anyone's come up to her yet. But that kind of stuff. That's really fun. The only disadvantages are sometimes we go a long time without seeing each other.
Mm-hmm.
Or like a long time, you know. And but we work through that. Thankfully, there's FaceTime and stuff like that.
I'm sure
it was harder when comics dated in the past.
Oh, but, yeah.
So that stinks, but it's like, well, she's doing her favorite thing in the world, and so am I.
Uh-huh.
So we're doing all right. Yeah.
So when you guys are like being a sounding board off of each other with a joke or a bit or something like that, have you guys ever had a disagreement on what the way the joke should go?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
I think, I can't think of any jokes in particular, but I know there's been times that she's given me a line and I'm like, I'll try it. And then it destroys. And then there's a couple of jokes that I've, and her and I fought about mine. She's like, you got to cut that. And I'm like, I'm not cutting it. I'm never cutting it. It's like bickering.
Yeah.
And, but I've given her lines. She's given me lines, and it's fun to see that from each other. Like, I think I listen to my sets a lot, and I'm trying to get rid of old ones, and I was listening, and I remember I told a line, and then I went, "Yes, it's yours," and then I heard her laugh,
uh-huh,
And I'm like, oh, okay. So it's just like this fun added joke for our relationship that she gave me the best line of the new joke, or I tell her she should cut something and then it kills in front of me. It's a fun inside joke. And also, she's a killer writer and I'm not bad either. So we're helping each other at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fun. It's like a relationship bickering thing.
Yeah. I'm lucky in that especially early on, my wife came to a lot of my shows. I didn't start till I was 52, so I'm late to the game. But I always took her advice because it was always right. And it's kind of like Gaffigan with his wife, you know, you know, the first couple times I didn't take the advice, it was like, okay, this joke just sucks and it needs to go away. But my ego, you know, your ego is like, hey, I love this joke. It's funny to me. But you know, I remember my first few open mics, the only thing I would ask my wife was I the worst? And I usually didn't get I was the worst, but then I started asking more questions. How'd this joke go? How'd this joke go? But she's definitely, even though she's not in comedy, she definitely knows what is funny universally, like what you're looking for, rather than going for a niche or something like that.
Right. And your spouse, comic or not comic, knows you at your funniest.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's why they're good people to talk to about it. Regardless of Caitlin's comic abilities, you know, I've made her cry laughing off stage. And if she can get me closer to doing that with an audience, yeah, I'm going to listen to everything she says.
Yeah. So. Have you ever toyed with changing up your stage style and delivery? Have you ever tried to be like, you know, match a Brian Regan type energy up there? Have you ever experimented with that? And how did that go for you?
I'm always trying to add more energy. I'm not trying to take any away, but I always worried that I'm too stiff and too slow. So I try to, I look at Brian and go, can I have a fraction of that energy? Because it's pretty tremendous. Joe List is one of my best friends, and we work together a lot. We're very similar people. His energy on stage, I don't think he gets enough credit for. It's a perfect energy for me, I think.
You guys look like you could be brothers, too.
Yeah, we're very, it's very much a brother. Yeah. I'll never tell him, but yeah, it's a brother relationship. And he's an energy that I'm like, if I could get to that level of boom, 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 and like just, he's really got you with his... feel safe in that energy.
Yeah.
You know, like even with new jokes, you're like, go ahead, Joe, this is great.
Yeah.
That's something I'm trying to get to.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually going through the same thing because I've got a new closer and I'm pretty deadpan through most of my bits. But the closer is like super high energy. It's about vape shops, and you know I get a chant going and all kinds of stuff, and I just don't I don't know if I should be building to that or if I should just hit it like all of a sudden I'm out of my character because this town needs more vape shops and it's just. So I'm really, that's one of the things I'm struggling with, and I haven't done enough like 15-20 minute sets to be able to build up to that in the last year or so because of moving and stuff. But I've always wondered about energy because I tell some folks that, you know, I'd really like to bring my energy up, and a lot of folks tell me that I shouldn't because the deadpan thing is what works for me. So it's weird.
Right. I think, I like natural is the best.
Yeah.
So if deadpan is your natural rhythm, I stick to that. But it doesn't, in my opinion, doesn't hurt to play with levels.
Yeah.
I have a joke about that on my new thing. So I'm still working on it, but it's four of my ex-girlfriends came out of the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, after the first one, you're like, oh, okay. Two and three, you're like, wow. But after four, you're like, am I a lesbian?
Yeah.
So on that last line, I used to yell it like confused outburst,
uh-huh,
rage kind of thing. And I'm like, where is this? Why am I doing this? And then I made it more natural. Like, it does go up a little bit. Okay, there now there's two and three, you know, and then, but it felt more natural to just, you know, a little bit higher, not yelling. And I think I did the yelling thinking that it equaled a killer laugh or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's actually a better laugh when I stay natural to the rhythm. So, right.
Yeah.
I think they know what I'm trying to say is I think they know when you're doing energy for energy's sake. And it,
yeah,
I think every joke has its levels of energy that you have to play with. That's another thing I'm guilty of. And I'm working on is you just because the lines are done, like all the jokes written parts are done, doesn't mean it's finished.
Uh-huh.
You can play with higher energy here, movement here, that kind of stuff. So yeah. I love energy and I'm still trying to figure it out.
Because yeah.
I think added level of punchline.
Right. It's really weird. And there was this guy up north that, his energy during most of his act was very similar to yours and his pacing was very similar, but his closer was this whole thing about Orson Welles, and Orson Welles doing all these different commercials, and he would go nuts. He would walk through the audience as Orson Welles and do all that stuff. And it punctuated his whole set.
Wow.
So well. And so that's one of the things that I always think about. I don't even think he does it anymore, but when he did do it, it was absolutely fabulous. And
right.
But it was like a different person. He just turned into this different person, but he was impersonating Orson Welles. So
right.
he got away with it. So it's I think I may be a little bit like you, that I overthink things a little bit too much. And then when it all comes down to it, you just got to try it a few different ways and then find out which one works the best.
Yeah. And I think that's where too much with people with anxiety, you and me, we think structure is going to equal safety.
Yeah.
You know, we want to not high, but we feel comfortable within the walls of rules and that kind of stuff. But on stage, I think it is good to fight that feeling. So I don't have a set list anymore. I write down what I want to say as far as I'd like to get to this joke at some point tonight. I want to do this joke, but I can't do orders anymore. And I think that has created some extra boost of energy. Cause it's with no safety net. It's like, all right, this joke. And that energy of me just pulling it and starting it kind of helps me see what I can do with it. And I have this nervous energy layer to it. I don't know. I'm still figuring it out, but that's what's fun about all of this.
Right. And I've been through the same thing because I used to be super structured. And when you're super structured, you make a lot more mistakes.
Right.
And I think it's because your head is so much into the list rather than your head being into performing. And when you don't go out with a list, you remember everything and more because it's your stuff. I mean, you should remember it.
Have you ever come up with a new line on stage?
Yeah.
Were you like being structured or were you being loose?
I was being loose. One of the few times in Indiana when I was being loose.
Right.
Yeah. It was, and it actually stuck, you know, it's part of the act now and it made it so much better. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's, I don't know. I think that works. There's many ways to write on stage and stuff, but I think when you're loose and but you did the work earlier that day, that creates a lot of opportunities. Mm-hmm.
Now, do you ever have the dream that you're about to go up and you've totally forgotten anything you're going to say?
I've only had the dreams where I couldn't get to the stage.
Okay. You couldn't, there was a Spinal Tap moment. You couldn't find it.
Don't lose it. I've had that and I've had on stage, but I can't hear myself. And I'm like, I'm in the audience.
Okay.
I haven't had too many, you know, what I've had is, talking to my hero nightmares or talking to, you know, oh, turns out this dead comedian hates me or something. that kind of stuff. I always worry I'm not working hard enough, and I think that's my brain showing
me. So in your career, in these 9 years, who has given you the best piece of advice that you still use today?
Man, the Brian one is a big one, is put yourself in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can just give you a couple of the ones he said, because he's had the most influence on my life and career. But he said, cream rises to the top. I mean, that's a thing we all know. But to hear it from someone that is a symbol of that in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like he did a sitcom and we all know him because of that. We know him because of his hard hitting stand up.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we know about him. So I think I equate that to, I think there's that Seinfeld quote, keep your head down in failure and your head up in success. Or no, I'm sorry. Head down in success and head up in failure.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the stuff that I've heard from Brian is just keep doing it. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's so cliche. It sucks that the cliches are cliches.
Yeah.
But my cat opened my door.
Cats are the best.
cats are the best. She must have felt how much I like this. It's always when I'm having fun in the interview.
Yeah.
It's never when I'm bored and need a cat.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wish I could remember other advice, but it's really just get up every day.
Mm.
Don't stop.
Right. Now the album's coming out in May. Is that available for pre-order yet?
April 8th, this Friday. April.
Okay. Excellent.
It will be available for pre-order. And then I, intend to do a live stream of it on YouTube. There's video of it, a video special, I guess.
Uh-huh. Cool.
Coming out the same day. I intend to do a live viewing of that at 9 p.m., but I'm still working that out.
Okay, excellent. Excellent. Yeah. What's the name of the album?
Before He Was Super.
All right. That's great. That's great. So where can people find you online and all that stuff, website and all that good stuff?
Website, Stephen Rogers Comedy. And the social media, Stephen Rogers Comedy on Instagram. And that's where I'm going to announce what time I'll be streaming the special. Mm-hmm. And all that stuff. So you can, and there's my Twitter is @NotSteveRogers. But all that, you go to one, it's linked to everything else.
Yeah.
So, but follow me on Instagram. I post reels of in the moment stand up, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, excellent. Well, it's been great having you on, and you know, I'll continue following you, and I'm really looking forward to the album coming out.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and this was so fun. Thanks for having me, Scott.